This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
The election is over. The debates, not so much. From APM, it's your post-election Marketplace Midday Update extravaganza. It's Wednesday, November 7th. I'm Jeff Horwich. Coming up, two dueling economists set the new bipartisan tone for us. We'll see how Wall Street's taking the news, and we'll look at folks now bracing for the full impact of healthcare reform. We'll break down Marketplace style two of the critical factors that seem to have swung this election. And along the way, we'll contemplate whether we can't all just buy a Snickers bar, get our tickets to The Hobbit, and move ahead together.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
With both Mitt Romney and President Obama last night calling for bipartisanship, first up, we thought we'd see if two economists with differing views could help us chart that road ahead. Jared Bernstein is a former chief economist for Vice President Biden. Now he's a senior fellow at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. Good morning.
And John Cochran is a Romney advisor, was a Romney advisor, and is a professor of finance at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. John, welcome to Marketplace.
Good morning.
This election was about two very different sets of economic beliefs about growth. And John Cochran, I'll start with you. What would you like to see this next Congress and administration take to heart from the Romney message?
Well, I don't think they're going to. You know, the situation we have now is a Democratic president who thinks the Congress is a bunch of Neanderthals. We have a Republican Congress who thinks the president is a socialist. So I can give all the advice I want, but no one's listening to me. They're going to be fighting it out for 4 years.
Blue sky it for me. If you had your druthers, you know, what should they learn from the Republican message on growth?
Oh, if I had my druthers, they would listen to the important economic messages, which is that the regulations they're imposing are going to really slow down the economy, that the tax chaos is something we need to fix. We need to put in the tax reform that Bull Simpson had in mind that was on the table last summer, get the economy growing again. Not much chance of any of that happening.
Jared Bernstein, how do you see the path to growth? And do you hear anything in there that you think could be grounds for compromise?
I do hear some grounds for compromise. And I think one of the things that I very much hope comes out of the election is some coming together around some common idea. John's right that supply side kind of trickle down tax economics, I think, was pretty soundly rejected. Governor Romney ran on a big tax cut across the board that was tilted towards high end folks, and it really didn't get him anywhere. And so I agree that we're not going to see that. But putting that aside, I think there's room for compromise.
Let's talk near term now. I want to hear from each of you your ideal way, in a nutshell, to see us veer away from the fiscal cliff. And Jared, let's start with you.
Look, these guys agree on 98% of the tax changes that should occur to avoid the fiscal cliff. Democrats, president, believe that the upper income tax cuts, which affect the top 2% of households, that part should expire. So if they can figure out a way to compromise, a lot of other stuff falls into place and we can avoid the cliff.
John? John, go ahead.
They may agree on some of that stuff, but I would not look towards them doing so. What I expect to happen is the same thing that's happened for the last couple of years, that we're going to have no budget. Then we're going to have every year in the middle of the night in January a big crisis that then gets resolved with a bunch of one-year extensions of this, that, and the other thing, and then we all come back in chaos again the next year.
Well, that's what you think is going to happen. I kind of want to hear what you think should happen, but it sounds like has your every hope been crushed by the outcome here? What should they do, John?
No, I would love them to get together, sing Kumbaya, and more importantly than the rates, which are in the headlines, we have a chaos of a tax code. I mean, reforming the tax code is much more important than the rates that we're talking about. No way is that going to happen.
Hey, look, the problem is that what John and I see as complexities that should be stripped from the code, somebody else sees as their critically important job creation protection. I do believe that the president and the Senate Democrats have run quite strongly on this issue of allowing the high-end Bush tax cuts to expire. Now, over 10 years, that raises $1 trillion for deficit reduction.
But if I could, our deficits are $1 trillion a year. You just gave me $1 trillion over 10 years, which is kind of a dream number. So that's like an eyedropper in Lake Michigan.
No, I disagree. I disagree. In fact, if you look at the accounting here, if we can reduce the 10-year budget deficit, cumulative deficit, by $4 trillion, we stabilize the debt as a share of GDP. And that's a bit of a holy grail in terms of fiscal rectitude, at least in the near term.
I want to talk healthcare reform in the limited time that we have here. On both sides, people will tell you it's not done. John, what do you think should be the next step in terms of particularly cost containment, which is the big, big issue?
Oh, yeah. Cost containment comes the same way, you know, Southwest Airlines reduced costs for air travel. You free up the market and you let supply competition happen. That's not happening. We're going to try cost containment one more time with price controls and regulations and so forth, and then costs are going to explode and they're going to end up rationing stuff.
And Jared Bernstein, what do you hope is next for healthcare reform?
Implementation of the Affordable Care Act is going to be a huge part of the president's second term agenda. That's going to lead to more coverage to people. And if it's successful, I don't know the answer to that yet, neither does John or anyone else, but if it's successful, it will slow down this pressure of healthcare costs. If it's unsuccessful, as John suspects, then it's definitely back to the drawing board.
Yeah, I think we can agree that that is going to be the big story. The big changes are not going to come out of Congress. It's going to be out of these implementation things. And then either we get to your kind of nirvana or we get to Greece, and we'll see which happens.
John Cochran is a professor of finance at the Booth School of Business, the University of Chicago, blogs at The Grumpy Economist. John, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
And Jared Bernstein is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. His blog called On the Economy is at jaredbernsteinblog.com. Jared, thanks.
My pleasure.
And now let's take a peek, shall we, at how investors are taking the news. Not terribly well, at least so far this morning. Wall Street perhaps not so crazy about the prospects for more gridlock in Washington at this moment, and it's gotten worse as the morning has gone on, so who knows what the day may hold. The Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500 are all down about 2 1/3%. For the Dow, that means it's off more than 300 points. European markets also generally fell more than 1% today. Markets were up in China, though. Maybe that's some relief, because Mitt Romney's especially tough talk on China, like his promise to label them a currency manipulator on, quote, day one, will not come to pass. Speaking of China, Marketplace's China bureau chief Rob Schmitz found a good crowd to join in watching the election returns. Rob dropped in on the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai, and he filed this report for us.
Hundreds of American businessmen and women watched the returns here on CNN, cheering each time a state was called for Obama. A straw poll taken by the chamber showed that most of its members who showed up favored the president, including Mike Crotty. He's from Ohio and he runs a textile business in Shanghai.
We need the continuity. He's a known entity here in China.
Crotty says the Chinese prefer continuity, and 4 more years for President Obama means a smoother trade relationship between the U.S. and China.
Especially in light of the fact that we've got the change in leadership going on here, by having a known entity in the States, I think be very beneficial for both countries.
Governor Romney's pledge to declare China a currency manipulator on day one wasn't popular with many in the business community here. But Crotty says neither are the sanctions Obama has placed on Chinese products. Crotty and many others here are hoping for an ease in trade restrictions on both sides of the Pacific. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
For a Wall Street perspective on the election and what it means for the economy, in the early hours this morning, my colleague Jeremy Hobson talked with one of our regular guests, Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial. And here's Jeremy. Well, so the president stays in office. The Democrats keep the Senate. The House stays with the Republicans. So what changes here?
Well, yeah, it doesn't feel like much changed, right? But they all come back now with the stamp of approval of the voters. And I think that's the key, is that we've had a reality check. And you come back in and now you've got the same team, but they're re-energized.
Well, the first order of business is going to be dealing with the fiscal cliff, which comes up at the end of the year. This package of spending cuts and tax increases that Congress is going to have to do something about. So what happens with that?
Well, that's maybe one of the most interesting things with an Obama victory, because, again, the thinking was it's going to be tough to get Congress to work together. What they have to do, what we're hoping to see in the next couple of months, is a deal where they agree to do budget reform, they agree to do tax reform, and they agree to work on it over the next year, and then they postpone all these increases that are coming in at the same time. We're going to be watching that really closely. They have 16 days to work on it before the end of the year.
Do you see taxes going up then either way?
I think taxes probably will go up. That was one of the biggest differences between the two candidates. Romney saying no tax increases, but will sort of nip away at deductions. Obama saying, no, there have to be tax increases. And I think the voters that one, at least, the voters seem to approve of.
What about spending cuts, though? I mean, is President Obama, with his reelection here, going to be able to avoid deep spending cuts as part of any grand deal?
No, I think you will see spending cuts. Remember, Obama actually cut military spending this year the most of any president in the last 30 years or so. I think that's one place where he now can cut further.
Defense.
And in fact, that's what the sequestration is lined up to do. Those are the automatic cuts they agreed to as part of the debt ceiling last year. So I think there will be cuts, but it's not necessarily the cuts to social spending that you would have seen with a Romney victory.
Do you, Chris, see any major legislation coming? I mean, the last time President Obama was elected, we got the stimulus package, we got the health care reform bill, we got the Wall Street reform bill. Any big things coming down the pike, do you think?
No, I don't think so. And that's kind of what he ran on. We've done the big things. Now let's make sure they work and let's focus on the economy. So the big things now, the biggest, is going to be fixing the deficit. Can we do a 10-year deficit deal?
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
With President Obama set for another 4 years, full implementation of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, if you like, seems on track. For some, like those with pre-existing conditions, or frankly, much of the insurance industry, that's kind of a relief. But the thought gives some small business owners an upset stomach. From Marketplace's healthcare desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, here's Dan Gorenstein.
Something's got to give. That's how John McGowan sees it.
My concern is that healthcare premiums last year went up 38%.
McGowan, who runs the Philadelphia area business Gasbreaker, believes the Affordable Care Act has only increased his health costs.
I know that everybody is going to pay a lot more for it ultimately, or have something that is a lot less than what they've been used to here.
The Urban Institute's Linda Blumberg says McGowan's 38% premium spikes are becoming a thing of the past. That's because now, under the ACA, insurance companies must provide states with actuarial evidence for rates to increase by more than 10%.
So we should see a lot more stability year to year.
Of course, not all business owners are upset about Obamacare. Ken Weinstein runs two Philadelphia restaurants. He hopes the law will ultimately make insurance more affordable. Without that, Weinstein says his business is exposed.
Anytime an employee is not able to make it into work, we're absolutely scrambling. Or in the worst case scenario, we're working with less employees.
While opinions vary, John McGowan says no small business owner really knows what to expect.
To some extent, we're all a bit in the dark on exactly whether the promise of the affordable portion of this Health Care Act is going to be the reality.
I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
And now, on the day after, a couple pieces that give us a look back at how we got here, marketplace style. First, about the money. The amount spent on this campaign is expected to top $6 billion. Much of that money did not come from the campaigns themselves, but rather from outside groups, super PACs that raised millions and then funneled that money into races. So, did all that money pay off? Marketplace's David Gura has that story from Washington.
There was ad after ad after ad.
Higher taxes, fewer jobs. Tim Kaine, bad for small business, too liberal for Virginia.
And many of them were not paid for by the campaigns themselves.
American Crossroads is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
The Citizens United Supreme Court case gave rise to super PACs, and in the presidential race alone, there was more than $1 billion worth of ads. But the focus was not just on the presidential race. Pro-Republican super PACs had hoped to propel the GOP to a majority in the Senate, but that didn't happen. Tony Fratto was an advisor to President George W. Bush, and he says the takeaway here is money can only do so much.
Nearly every case where a Republican Senate candidate lost, it's hard to say that it was a great candidate or that candidate ran a terrific campaign.
But Heather McGee with the think tank Demos says even if super PACs didn't get every victory they wanted, they did get something.
Today, the phones start ringing, and there are people in Washington who have to take the calls of the millionaires, and in some cases billionaires, who purchased exactly what they wanted, which is influence and access over the next 2 to 4 years.
That is, until the next campaign, which Howard Dean, the former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, says will be even more expensive.
In 2016, this is going to be mayhem.
It'll get harder and harder for younger candidates, Dean says, to get some name recognition, to get their message out there, if they're competing with super PACs. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
It also appears car country played a big role in President Obama's reelection. Michigan and Ohio both benefited from the auto industry bailout and both went for the president last night. Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff has that story.
President Obama won most of Ohio's big cities last night and a blue stripe of counties at the top of the state. On one end is a Toledo Jeep plant. On the other, the factory where they build the Chevy Cruze. And in between, thousands who work in auto parts suppliers. If the bailout had a galvanizing effect, it would be here. Bruce Belzowski of the University of Michigan says it affected morale.
When you look at the things that people were saying about how they felt after the auto bailouts, I think the effects on people's livelihoods was dramatic.
Exit polls yesterday show a majority of Ohioans favored the auto industry bailout. Ohio actually has an unemployment rate now of 7%, better than the national average. Many economists think far more Midwesterners would have lost their jobs if not for the government loans that shored up GM and Chrysler. Then there was that ad from Mitt Romney late in the campaign claiming, wrongly, that Chrysler was going to ship jobs to China.
That really didn't set well with our members.
Ken Lortz is the director of the UAW Region 2B, which covers Ohio and Indiana. He says his members worked harder to elect Obama after that ad ran. But it's unclear whether the ad changed any votes or was a sign the Romney camp was worried about its fortunes in Ohio. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Interesting little voting-related sidebar as we wind down here. We're likely in for the now quadrennial round of questions about voting irregularities and electronic voting machines. This led tech blogger Howard Marks, he writes at networkcomputing.com, to muse about the time he had spent working for the casino industry. Marks points out that modern slot machine makers must turn over the source code for every machine and open them up to full audits by the gaming commissions. Compare that, then, to the voting machine industry, where makers guard their proprietary code and the system suffers constant complaints about transparency. Marks argues gambling with our future deserves perhaps at least the same scrutiny as gambling on nickel slots. And finally, as we enter this grand new age of bipartisanship, the media consultant Engage has been cross-referencing people's political preferences with their tastes for various other things, all this derived from data they found on Facebook. For example, liberals prefer Chipotle and Jamba Juice. Conservatives like Outback Steakhouse. Liberals like Red Bull. Conservatives, evidently, like Campbell's Soup. Conservatives like Dancing with the Stars. And liberals like to watch So You Think You Can Dance. That's an interesting one to put on your little amateur psychologist hat and think about. Some things, though, evidently, according to Engage, we can all agree on. Snickers bars, Seinfeld, and Lord of the Rings are a few that caught my attention. That's all for today's Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.